Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Project Empowerment with Kathleen, a show dedicated to empowering lives everywhere by bringing you people, stories, ideas, and inspiration to help each of us make our world a better place. And if you wish to participate during today's show, please log into the chat room at projectempowerment.info, or you can call in with your questions at area code 347-945-5441. And today I am so excited to have on author Karen Koenig to discuss her new book, Outsmarting Overeating, Boost Your Life Skills, and End Your Food Problems. So now anyone who struggled to make peace with the refrigerator and the scale can identify with the vicious cycles of painfully forging a bit of progress, only to see it vanish after getting fed up with the struggle of eating healthfully, and they become so tired of thinking about all those should and shouldn'ts surrounding food that they throw up their hands in despair and try to accept their eating as it is until that all becomes too frustrating, and then the cycle continues. So her new book is a powerful new approach to stopping the cycle once and for all, and the solution it provides has very little to do with food and everything to do with developing the essential skills that the majority of overeaters lack for coping with life's up and downs. And we're going to be discussing all of this and more, and I'm so excited to have Karen on. So thank you so much for joining me today, Karen.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Yeah, so, you know, when I was reading your book, I mean, so many light bulbs went off, you know, with ideas. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is exactly what I've been dealing with, or this is, I identify with this, or whatnot. And first of all, before we really dive into like the eight essential life skills and more of these details, if it's all right, if you can kind of give us a background about you and your work and how you even got involved with doing this type of work with helping with, you know, helping people with healthy eating, as well as just, I'm assuming other things, because you are also a you're a psychotherapist and an eating coach and a motivational speaker. So if you can give us a little bit of background about your work, that would be wonderful.
Sure. Like many people who write books or do therapy with certain issues, I had my own eating problems about half a lifetime ago. I was a chronic dieter, binge eater. I'd gain weight, lose weight, gain weight, lose weight, very yo-yo cycle. And then in the 80s, I read a book that said I could learn to eat according to appetite, and I practiced that, and I followed through and started teaching in a program that taught that approach, and would have people coming up to me after class and saying, oh, yeah, that was really great. Could I talk to you privately? I had an MED, and it was then that I said to myself, I think if I'm going to do this work, I better do it right. So I went back, and I got a master's in social work. So it was the two pieces that really put me in a place to be helpful to troubled eaters. One is overcoming my own food struggles, and also having the general clinical knowledge. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I practiced in Florida and in Massachusetts. So that's what got me where I am today.
Well, you know, I have to say, you know, over the years, the first half of my life, no, I should say a little over half of my life, I was always kind of a healthy size, quote unquote, but I wasn't really healthy. I was slender, but that didn't mean I was healthy. And then, you know, my life switched and had kids and I gained weight. And, you know, since then I've carried an extra 30 pounds and it's like I'll lose 20 and I'll gain it back. And it's like I couldn't figure out why was I in this place, because I used to always be slender, you know, what happened? And honestly, I have to say, after reading your book, what we were sharing before the show started is a lot of light bulbs went off, thinking, oh my gosh, I never thought of it that way. Or, I've got a bunch of diet books, I've got all sorts of books that I've done where I do this eating plan thing and I drop the weight and then it would come back on, because I never thought about the life skills. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is so important and so powerful. So first of all, thank you for putting this all together, because it was powerful.
Well, you're welcome. You know, this is my sixth book, and five of them are for the lay public. And the way I've written them is thinking about what clients teach me about what they need to learn. And my first book was about appetite. Oh, gee, if they got in touch with appetite, that would help. And then I realized there were all these emotional problems. So then I wrote another book. And my most recent book, before Outsmarting Overeating, speaks to the issue you're talking about, which it's called Starting Monday, which is why we do this cycling. And there are a lot of physical reasons we do, because when we restrict food, then we want it, because our body says, hey, you know, I must be starving. But the other thing is the psychological, there are often unconscious underlying conflicts that we have about giving up food for anything but nourishment and losing weight. And so that book addresses that. And the more work I do with clients, the more I learn about the issue.
And
very,
you know,
complex.
It is really complex. I mean, and this is what I loved so much about reading this specific book, because I'm new to your work. And so it really delves into a lot of stuff that it's like I personally didn't even consider. It's like one of the sections you talk about your parents. How were your parents when you were growing up about, you know, about the self-care? You know, and I was thinking about, like, my parents, when I was younger, they went through, there was abuse in the family. My dad was abusive, et cetera. But they would go through these crazy diets, and they'd expect the kids to go on them with them. And, like, I remember going on this one eating thing with them where it was all fruit. They were on this all-fruit diet.
Oh,
and with growing children, that's probably not the healthiest, but that's what they were doing, and I wanted to support my parents. And, I mean, I was already skinny as a rail back then, so, you know, and I used to run, and I used to do all of this stuff. And it's like I watched my parents do this yo-yo dieting, and they'd very verbally complain about their weight, or they'd complain. And it's like all of these messages, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, until I was reading your book, I'd forgotten about a lot of that stuff, and I realized that's the stuff that's been kind of like inundated and programmed in me. And then we look at society and all of the, I call them stinky magazines, you know, the fancy magazines with the airbrushed women and the perfume and all that stuff. It's like how unhealthy this society is. And and you address a lot of that in your work. And so I'd really like to know how your process. So you have the eight essential life skills, and I really appreciated also how you refer to people as dysregulated eaters. So maybe if I could, I'm jumping all over the place here, but I'd like to focus on dysregulated eaters, how you came up with that phrase, because I personally identify myself with that, so I'd love to get your input on how you came up with that, and then we could talk about the eight essential life skills.
I also use the word troubled eaters.
I
wanted a general term that did not speak to weight, which I don't think of as the problem, or to just one end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And so dysregulation really nailed it for me. It's the whole issue of what's too much and what's too little, which is one of the things that I address in the book, what I call people having an enough disorder, not knowing with food and with other things when enough is enough. And it's part of emotional dysregulation, the whole issue of over and under eating. So the other thing, I didn't like the word dysfunctional. It's so negative. Dysregulated, you know, it just to me speaks to exactly what we as troubled eaters feel.
Right, right. Well, it makes, like, when I read it, I identify, like, I'm off track because I didn't have the skills to get back on track, and you help with a lot of those things. You know, that's where the eight essential life skills come in. I mean, it's wellness and physical self-care and handling emotions, living consciously, building and maintaining relationships, self-regulation, like we were discussing, problem solving and critical thinking. That chapter that one really hit home with me personally, and we could talk about that more in a little bit. Then there's setting and reaching goals, and then balancing work and play. And it's all of this stuff, like you were saying earlier, it's so very complex, and how complex it is, and how we identify how we consume food. It's not overwhelming. It's just, for me, it was just fascinating because it opened a lot of new ideas, and I was really, really excited to read your work. So,
I think when we're excited is when we use the new ideas. So that's very good.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, so for my listeners tuning in, there are at the end of every chapter, there is a section to kind of, it reviews everything, and there's also an assessment at the beginning of the book about where you're at, your life skills pre-assessment, and then you do it again at the end of the book. So I do recommend for the listeners to read it from cover to cover and take the time to really go through it, because there is a lot of great details and a lot of wonderful examples that you use through here just to help explain a lot of, you know, all of this stuff, and I'm shuffling through it right now. But like with the handling emotions, you know, about how do we handle those emotions? You know, we're upset, we're stressed, work is going crazy. How are we doing that? Are we stuffing it with food? Is it, you know, numbing out? And you kind of go into a little bit more of the physical reactions about why people, like they rush to the carbs or they rush to that because of it calms the body. Is that what I'm understanding? If I remember correctly?
Yes.
Explaining mm-hmm. that? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we could call dysregulated eating a nervous system disorder as easily as we could call it anything else. But some people are just mindless eaters. Others are compulsive eaters. They feel they must finish everything on their plate. Others are emotional eaters. I like people to really look at the different pieces of their eating, that it's not all the same. There are times that they are just compulsive. They're just not paying attention, and it's mindless. And there are other times that they, you know, if you asked and pushed them, they'd say, yeah, I'm really eating because I need comfort. So being able to neutrally, curiously, openly look at these things and not feel shame and not feel angry at yourself and not berate yourself and just say, hey, everybody's learning life skills because none of us have perfect life skills because the people who taught us had imperfect life skills. So we're all learning them. There's no shame in it. If nobody taught us how to fly a plane, we wouldn't be able to do it. If we wanted to learn how to fly a plane in adulthood, we'd go out and take lessons. So this book includes those lessons.
Right. And you give skill boosters. You give examples. Like, okay, for example, I flipped open to page 63 about, it's on handling emotions. Like, and here was a bullet point. If you're standing in front of the mirror, hating your body, avoid insisting, I look terrible, I'm so fat, I can't bear looking at myself. Instead, shift to, my eyes are great, so blue and sparkly. I love that my body is getting healthier. And then step away from the mirror. And it's these little things, these little life skills that you build up over time, and it shifts your perception, and it shifts your attitude. And, you know, over time, it's about learning to, like we've been discussing, learning to develop healthier life skills that helps deal with the emotions. It deals with the anxiety or stresses or whatnot. You wrote something later on in the book that I found really interesting about people who have already really good life skills, and they have a pretty good balanced life and this and that, and they end up not really having too much of an eating issue. I find it interesting because I've read books from people like that, or they're super healthy, they've been fit all their lives, this and that, and they really don't get what it's like to be someone who's dysregulated, and it's what I'm grateful that you do get it because you've been there, and it's hard to take advice from someone who's like, oh, just eat more vegetables and exercise more, and they don't really get what's going on behind the scenes, as it were.
Well,
and,
I think for a couple reasons. One is sometimes it's just a failure of empathy. And these people are not very empathic to begin with. Other times, you have to make the connection for them that they may be dysregulated in other areas and not be able to say no. Maybe it's shopping. Maybe it's work. I don't know. Maybe it's spending too much or too little time with the kids. So that they may be out of whack, and or drugs or alcohol. I mean, it could be anything, or temper. And for them to make that connection, what it's like for me, how I struggle with this is how the other person struggles. So there's different ways of approaching that. But, you know, we don't live in a society that values this kind of in-depth, you know, insight or trying to understand other people. It's really very superficial, behavioral, quick fix. And on top of that, we live in the most fat-phobic, thin-obsessed culture in the history of time. So there's all these pressures to just, well, my goodness, there's a million books on it. Just do it.
So
there's that aspect, too, that we're told we're failures as opposed to diets failing, because they do in studies. You know, diets are the gateway behavior to dysregulated eating and eating disorders.
Well, you talk about this in your book about diets don't work long term and how they can actually make people fatter. And I have to confess, you know, it's like I dropped 20 pounds, but then I gained back 25. And it wasn't like overnight. It was just over time, because I wasn't, the habits that I tried to adopt didn't stick, because I didn't deal with whatever other emotional underlying factors there are. And that's something I want to discuss with you, is how do you work with people? I mean, your book does describe this, and I really encourage people to read it, but how do you work with people to really figure out what's really going on? It's not about food. It has to do with something else that's happening in their world. So what are some of the tips and suggestions that you do to help really kind of figure out what's triggering the person to be an emotional eater, or be a compulsive eater, or in whatever the thing is that's tripping their trigger every time?
Well, you know, I have to say, after I've been doing this for over 30 years, 35 years maybe, there's very little that I haven't seen. And I work mostly with overeaters. Maybe they had been restricted eaters at one point, but I don't work with the other end of anorexia, sometimes with bulimia. And because I've had my own problems, I pretty much am rarely surprised. So I might hear them say, I eat as a reward. And so then I will talk to them about there's an entitlement often underneath that, and an anger underneath that. Well, I deserve this. And then that will lead us into talking about why they would feel unentitled to begin with, that we don't eat because we're entitled. We eat because this is a positive thing for us to do. I would say 80% maybe of my clients eat in a way that is a rebellion. And so I'm always looking for that and listening for that. That's sort of when people say they crave something, and then their voice says, well, I don't care. I'm just going to eat it. So we talk about, how did they get that way? How would they be somebody who is so angry about this, and the kind of restrictions, food and otherwise, it's not always food, that they had in childhood, that they made what were interpersonal problems now intrapsychic. So when they reach out and punch somebody, they're punching themselves. So that's like a real eye-opener. And just what you touched on earlier, the whole thing of self-care. You know, I'll say to them, so do you love yourself? And if there's any hesitation, this is what I often hear,
Well,
yeah, I think I do. I try to. I know there's something under there because people who love themselves just look at me and go, well, duh, yeah. So I go after that because that's where it starts. If you love your car, you take good care of your car. You love your kids, mm-hmm. you take good care of them. But if you're not doing the same thing for yourself in many ways, not just with food, if you're not taking the best care of yourself that you can take, that to me says something about how you value and love yourself. So those are sort of the things I expect and I'm always looking for and generally end up talking about.
Right.
The things
you
that
know,
people
that
don't,
kind of
a, they don't think about
yeah.
them, but I know
right,
generally
right.
they're there.
Mm, yeah.
It's a very
and, you know,
different
that
approach.
I think it's about getting, boy, yeah, I don't think people really, you're right, they don't think about that. They're just looking at the pictures and the images and what they think they need to be looking like and not really realizing that the issue that they're having is very, you know, it's a very deep issue that's built into our psyche, as it were, by how
yes.
we were raised, what our life was when we were growing up and the messages that we were given as children. And I'm not saying this to blame parents. Our parents were working off of what they were raised with. So it's like
yep.
we have the choice to make the change, and that's where education and empowerment comes in because, you know, I could blame my parents all I want, but that's still not going to change how I'm looking right now because I haven't lived with my parents in 30 years. So I mean, it's like there's no excuse other than my own excuses, you know. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting how this all unfolds. And, you know, I really enjoyed Chapter 7 on problem solving and critical thinking. You know, in the job that I do, I work my day jobs at a hospital, and I have to do a lot of critical thinking and problem solving in the department I work at. I work in the emergency department. I'm not a nurse, but I'm part of the administrative, the insurance and the processing, and we help the ED flow, as it were, with all the stuff that we have to deal with there. And there is a lot of decisions and, you know, quick thinking that we have to do to help the nursing staff and the doctors. And oftentimes, you know, and I was thinking about this the other night, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, we don't really think about all of this. We put so much focus and effort in our jobs that we often forget our own bodies and that we think we just eat to satisfy the gut because we're hungry. We don't really think about what we're putting in our mouths, or we do, but we're like you were just saying earlier, it's a rebellion, you know, like I'll buy that pizza because it's quick and easy and I don't have to think much about it. And I've got two kids and, you know, the whole shebang. But it's so important to really understand, you know, that how effective that is in how we pick our food, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know if there was something you wanted me to respond to.
No,
there.
You're fine. I was like
okay.
in a pause there for a moment. No, you're fine. If you want to jump in, please do, because, you know, it's like I was saying at the beginning of the show, there was so many light bulbs that went off for me, and I'm sure if it happened to me, I'm sure it's going to happen to a lot of other people because, you know, there's so many things that we do. Like, I've done that. I've beat myself up for food that I've eaten, and then I'll just keep taking another bite because I'm like, screw this. I'm already here. I may as
yeah.
well finish it type of thing. And it's like, well, but why am I doing that? And that's the part that I'm loving about reading this work is figuring out, well, why am I doing this? Why am I feeling the way I'm feeling? What is this about? And so you talk about how to do that. I think you if I remember correctly, you discuss keeping a gratitude journal and other things. Please refresh my memory
journal.
If I'm not reading.
I'm sorry? It's a pride journal. Pride.
Oh,
pride
yeah.
journal.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Because dysregulated eaters and generally focus on the things that they don't do well and the things they're ashamed of. And so that's all about selective attention. And confirmation bias. You see, I overate again, but they didn't, you know, what they're not focusing on is the three times during the day that they didn't overeat.
Right.
And pride also, in certain families, you're not encouraged to feel proud. people associate it with selfishness, boasting, entitlement, and really being proud is the greatest feeling in the world. And that's how we move forward because we feel proud. We tend, even though the function of shame is to tap us on the shoulder and say, well, you know, you're not really being the person you want to be. The fact is that doesn't always move us forward. What does is feeling proud, which just means I'm glad I did what I did. I'm glad I am who I am. Doesn't mean I'm better than the next person or worse than the next person. Anyway, I just wanted to address and encourage people to write pride journals because that can make a huge shift in your thinking. The other thing I wanted to mention when you talk about what are the things I see in clients is that this all or nothing kind of thinking that you're talking about. Well, if I have one bite, I might as well finish the whole thing. There are a whole bunch of personality traits that correlate to dysregulated or troubled eaters. And one of my books called Nice Girls Finish Fat, Put Yourself First and Change Your Eating Forever, speaks to the not just women who are like that, but people who they take care of others. They feel selfish when they're taking care of themselves. They don't give themselves a lot of downtime. They're overachievers, want to be productive, all or nothing thinking, sometimes difficulty delegating, and being hard on themselves. Kind to other people, very compassionate, lovely people, but very hard on themselves. And so one of the things I teach is self-compassion. And it's just, it's another one of those things that if, when you switch to self-compassion, everything changes. So it is, and it doesn't even take that long to not be so hard on yourself. Honestly, it doesn't. You just practice. You catch yourself when you're hard on yourself, say, I'm not going to go there, and then you say something nice about yourself.
Wow, yeah. And yeah. You know, it's like, I don't know. I mean, I want to say, you know, this, you know, I work in a place where there's a lot of, okay, here, I'm going to give this as an example. How easy it is to compare ourselves to others. Like, I work with, you know, a lot of the staff, there's some of the staff that I work with that are like into extreme sports. That's their way, that's how they de-stress. It's wonderful. And it's amazing. And then there's some that are so strict about all of their food. They like micromanage every little thing. And I see all of these different examples. And it's like I'm thinking to myself. And then I look at myself thinking, well, I may not be as slender as I'd like, but I can still hike 4.5 miles and not feel super sore at the end, you know, because that's one of the activities that I really enjoy doing. And I'm doing things that a lot of people don't do or don't like to do, et cetera. But it's how often we do that. We compare ourselves to others, and it's like we've got to stop that because it's not a healthy comparison. I want to say there's got to be this. I think this is where in one of your other chapters you talk, it has to do with the balancing. Well, it's balancing work and play, which is probably not quite exactly what I'm referring to, but it's
maybe
about, you know,
self-regulation.
Chapter? I think so. Yeah, because it's finding that healthy balance about being proud about yourself, about, you know, like we were saying earlier, look at the qualities in your body that is beautiful, and you know, it's not about saying who cares what others think, because really it doesn't matter what other people think, but it's about what you think about yourself. And finding those good parts, and somehow I'm getting way off track. But anyways, for some reason, that what you were saying was reminding me of that, because it's like I'm one of those. You know, the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I've done that. I'll compare myself to these women that run 100-mile marathons, you know, or 100-miler things, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, that's so amazing. And you know, and then I'll discredit myself, and I climbed Mount Rainier twice. And I will beat myself up because I'm not this skinny twig. And I'm like, well, because that's my body just isn't just isn't, you know. And, you know, I carried a 45-pound pack off up the side of the mountain, and I was a size 14, 16, something like that, somewhere in between. And it's like I'll beat myself up because I'm not this skinny little thing. But I did something that a lot of the skinny people couldn't do. No offense to the thin ones out there. But how easy it is to do these unhealthy comparisons, you know.
Well, and I would add how easy it is to stop. Because if you want to stop, you pay attention to what you're saying. And you stop the thought. And you say, I'm not going to tear myself down. What we want to do is value our own uniqueness. Honestly, I live in Sarasota, Florida, and there was just a big run across this long bridge we have, which is a beautiful bridge to walk. When I heard about it, and I exercise every day. I mean, I do short walk with my husband at night, and I have a little gym area in my house, and I swim. So I like to be active, but I heard about that run, and I said, I'd rather be run over by a truck. It doesn't interest me. But I'm thrilled for other people, and I can support other people doing it. So it's finding what you value and work and what works for you. The other thing I was going to say about the whole tearing yourself down is, you know, truly, if we have parents who value us and treat us kindly, fairly, and compassionately, for the most part, that's how we treat ourselves, because we see them modeling that, and the interactions we have with them foster that, being self-forgiving and kind and understanding oneself. If we have parents who are hard on themselves, not that they would say it, but who have very high standards for themselves and or who treat us that way, that's really where it starts. What is said to us is what we say to ourselves. So this is the good news as an adult is you can decide what you want to say to yourself, what you want to think, what you want to feel, and make new choices, which gives you a whole different life, not just around food, but around everything.
Right. Well, you know, you have a section in here, too, about a lot of the beliefs that we have grown up with and then what to do to switch it around. Everything from adults don't have, this is on the balancing work and play, but this applies to everything, you know, like you've got to clean your plate. Well, why, how do you change that to where that's a healthier phrase? I mean, I've caught myself, my boys, I have two sons, they're 9, they're going to be 10 and 14 here in just a few weeks, and they both have type 1 diabetes. So food is a huge issue in the house because I have to count carbs on everything they eat to figure out their insulin and make sure that, you know, their body is, you know, maintained. And so I do everything in my power to keep it as healthy as possible. So I understand, you know, like, is this all you're going to eat? Are you hungry for more? You know, I don't want to regulate, this is all you can have, no more food, because it'll make you fat. I don't even talk about that because my kids are skinny. They're slender, very active little boys. But then I catch myself with my own food, and I don't regulate myself in a healthy way. And it's like, it's so interesting when I was reading this, because I was catching myself on my own thought patterns thinking, oh my gosh, I need to tweak this or adjust this so it's not an unhealthy thing coming, not just coming out of my mouth for my kids, but for myself, that inner dialogue, that inner talk that we do on an ongoing basis as to why we behave the way we do or why we think the way we do. And go ahead.
No, go on.
Oh, no, and I was just going to talk about balancing work and play and how powerful it is to find that. I mean, this is some of the things that I do with Project Empowerment is I encourage women, especially, you know, because I work with women who also are survivors of domestic violence. And I said, you know, when you get yourself in a safe place and you're doing something with your life and you're rebuilding, part of your rebuilding process is finding something that's bigger than you. find a way to donate your time, find a way to do something. You know, and you use example, you know, not everybody could be doctors across borders, but they can find something to do. You know, I work at a local children's hospital. It's a nonprofit organization, and there's always opportunities for people to donate time or energy or whatnot. So there's always something that they can do to help fill that emptiness that they could have in their life, which can stem back to the emotional stuff that they might be dealing with. It. Maybe their life doesn't feel fulfilled. So I appreciate how you interweave all of that stuff through your book.
Well, you know, when you talk about work and play, you know, one of the places where certainly troubled eaters get into trouble is they're working and they push themselves so hard to do it perfectly, to not leave anything incomplete, to check off the to-do list, to do it right, and then they resent it and they want a break and they want to kick back. So then they do something, I don't know, they watch TV or they play a word game, you know, on the computer, whatever it is, or they're reading, and they feel guilty. So they don't they don't enjoy the work part of it because they're too busy feeling resentful and wanting to play, and they don't enjoy the play part because they feel guilty because they're not being productive, and then they end up going to food. Because they'll just say, well, I have to eat. So I really encourage people to understand the difference between work and play and look at them as value neutral. One is not better than the other. I don't care what your parents said. I don't care what Puritan culture says. And I don't care what religion says. In terms of psychology and mental health, work and pleasure and play are equal. And play just means doing something for pleasure in the moment without a goal. So when people are able to do that, no matter how they play, and somebody might do a run for play, I'll write a blog because I love to write, or I'll read a book. That will really help them get back in balance. And balance is what we're looking for in most parts of life.
Right. And, you know, and part of the balance is one of the sections that you have in here is in setting and reaching goals. And it's important to, you know, obviously create things that are in bite-sized pieces and manageable. And I think that's one of the biggest things is you really kind of dive into that is about, you say this dysregulated eaters are masterful at setting goals, but then oftentimes those goals are you know, we might reach that goal, but then we go back to other bad habits again. So let's discuss this chapter because I thought it was a really powerful one.
Well, you know, I'm probably one of the few, I don't know, maybe authors or considered experts, who I'm really not a big fan of goals. And I understand that, you know, I did that whole chapter and I researched books on goals, not for this population so much. I rarely use them. I mean, this is my sixth book. I do, you know, other kinds of things as well. I don't set goals. I pretty much follow an organic process of what I want to do. You know, if I said to you, okay, you won the lottery and you have $4 million waiting for you, you would not have to set a goal to get there. You wouldn't say, well, what was it that I was going to do? Oh, yeah, I remember. That was my goal. Go pick up the check at the lottery office. we make commitments and we set goals because in the moment we don't really feel like doing it so much. And we think we're going to, if we push ourselves to do it, we will do it. So this has a couple pieces. And so one of it is really knowing yourself. If setting goals and pushing yourself hasn't worked in the past, it's probably not going to work now. And what would happen if instead, when you wanted to do something and found yourself not doing it, you asked yourself, I wonder why? with curiosity, no judgment, wonder why I'm not doing it. And you will always find a reason. The reason perhaps that you haven't been going to the gym, even though it was your goal, is because you're so busy, or you're uncomfortable people seeing, you know, your body in gym clothes, or it's too far away, or you're comparing yourself to other people, or you're too tired.
Yeah.
So then you address those issues. I mean, to me, life is really about I want this and I don't want it, or I want this and I won't, and I want that. How am I going to take care of myself best?
Yeah.
So it's sort of funny. That's what my goal chapter is about. It's more about it, not setting goals, although I do explain how to set them and maintain them. But it's really understanding what holds us back from naturally doing what's best for us.
Right. And, you know, I enjoyed this because, in the self-help industry, there's so many people out there that have there's a gazillion books out there on how to set goals and how to keep your goals. I mean, I think you did a Google search or an Amazon search that pulled up 68,680 results on goal setting. And it's like I got caught up in that too, thinking, well, that's what I needed to do before I even read books about that. I used to write down, I would call them my intentions, because this is stuff that I wanted to accomplish, so I'd write it down. And I didn't make it like a regimented thing. I just went through what I enjoyed and I'd cross off what I accomplished. And pretty much for the most part, I accomplished everything that I set out my mind to do. And it wasn't this high pressured thing. And then I started, you know, I confess, you know, with all the stuff that's been going on in my personal life, I've read a lot of books on this topic plus a bazillion other things. And I'll see that theme about goal setting, about pick your top three and focus on that. And if you don't get to all those three, then shift it to the next day and just focus, focus, focus. And all this drive, drive, drive. And I'm like, that's just going to drive me bananas, because then I start rebelling against myself. And
exactly.
I was like, I don't want to do this.
It's work.
You know, well, yeah. Why are we putting ourselves under so much pressure? You know, I'll do this too. One time when I was training for Mount Rainier, there was a day I was just having a really, really off day. I knew I needed to, because part of my structured training, because it was, you know, stuff that I needed to be able to accomplish in order to carry the pack and for endurance and all of this. And I always really enjoyed the workouts. I often miss though some of that training routine, because it got me outside. You know, I still do hikes and stuff, but it wasn't as intense as it was when I was training for the mountain. But there were certain hikes that were just grueling because it was exhausting. My calves would hurt. I mean, everything would just hurt, but I felt good at the end. But there was one day, I think I hiked in a mile up the trail, and I just stopped and I thought, you know what, I'm not feeling it today. And I turned around, and it was a 45-minute drive, and I turned around and went back to the car and I said, this isn't happening today. And I started beating myself up for it, but then I realized something in me just needed to take that break. I'm like, you know, it's okay. It's okay to just do what you need to do. I think my guest fell off the line, so hopefully she'll be back in just a moment. But yeah, it's such an interesting thing about how these goals and how these things happened with us, and how food and eating and all of this is all intertwined, and how her book Outsmarting Overeating is so powerful. And hopefully she'll join us back on the call again. But yeah, so there was a section, and I wanted to share while we're waiting, is on the topic of setting and reaching goals. There was a paragraph that I really found interesting. It says, evidence points to the fact that we push ourselves to commit to goals for eating, exercise, education, financial security, and so on in order to overcome valid doubts that we'll succeed. Commitment portends, or rather pretends, certainty of our success. It feels like holding a guarantee in our hand. Hi, Karen. Thanks for coming back on. Are
yeah,
you there?
I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, the line went dead.
It happens. It's all good.
Yeah.
No worries.
Yeah.
Excellent. I was just sharing with the listeners a little section in setting and reaching goals, and I really enjoyed that paragraph about how we push ourselves as if it's like some sort of a guarantee in our hand that if we reach this specific goal that, you know, we've, like you said, like we've won the lottery or something, and all this pressure that we put on ourselves to get to this thing.
I think then we think we're good people. We did it right. So
yeah.
There are a couple of things that I teach clients. One is to not look at decisions or goals as right or wrong. There's the best thing I can do for myself with the information I have right now. That's it.
Right.
Unless somebody's got a crystal ball, because I don't have one. I can only make my best decision right now. And best is different than right, because if you're not right, you're wrong. So that, and then I talk a lot with clients about the words they use. Research tells us that external motivators don't work as well as internal motivators. So words that are external, excuse me, are I should do this, I need to, I have to, I must, I ought to, I'm supposed to. Don't want to say those. The words you want to say are I want, would, like, prefer, desire, wish, I wish to, I'd love to. Because if you, what I do with clients, in fact, I did it twice with people yesterday. I asked them to stand up, and then I poked them in the back, and I told them to go do something. And I ask them how that feels, and they say usually, well, that's annoying. So then I asked them to, I said, well, that's what shoulds are like somebody just poking us, and we just want to turn around and say, will you cut it out? And then what I'll do with them is I'll just sort of smile and beckon them forward with my finger. And what they usually feel then is curiosity and interest. And so when we go from the heart, we want to do something, we're more likely to do it than if we feel we should. And Loretta LaRoche, who's a comedian and educator, she calls it stop shoulding on yourself. And that's really what we do. So just watching that language is another shift. And also, you know, if you tell yourself you should do it, you need to, you're likely to rebel. But if you really want to figure out how to move forward, you've got, I want to do this, and I want to do this. And at least you're on an equal playing field with the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
So just doing those kinds of things and changing language makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. And it actually gets better results.
Right. And, you know, and that kind of goes into, I wanted to discuss for a couple minutes about how people want a quick fix. And how vital that internal language is in regards to that thing. I mean, just the other night, I was flipping channels on TV. I was relaxing, and I think I saw probably 3 or 4 commercials on the skinny diet pill or the blah 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 whatever exercise machine or the yada 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 thing that's, you know, guaranteed to make you lose, you know, X amount of weight. And I thought that's what's wrong with the messages that are out there, because it's not teaching you life skills. It's not teaching you how to cope. They're just trying to peddle their wares. I'm not saying it doesn't work, but you actually discuss that in your book too about do your research. Don't get caught up in the emotion of whatever they're claiming is the scientific research says, blah, 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 you know. It's like, is that really what they say? What about any other, you know, are there any complaints against the company, you know? And do your due diligence research, because we live in this fast food society, and people want things yesterday. And but you touched on something that it hit a chord for me, and it says that some people don't want to lose weight because it makes them feel physically, sexually, and emotionally vulnerable. And I thought, wow, because, you know, like, and I'm going to share something that's personal here. You know, I was abused. My first ex-husband tried to kill me. When we were married, you know, I started gaining a little bit of weight, and he would complain that I was fat, so I stopped eating. And I became anorexic, and I dropped, I'm almost 5'9", and I dropped to a size 6. And then he complained because I was too thin. I mean, it's like I was on this yo-yo because of the abuse and the trauma that I was going through, until I finally fled from my life. And when I fled, you know, my eating, I just ate whatever I could because I was starving, and it was like it's taken me a very long time to, like, wow, I've got to figure out what's healthy for me. And then I started gaining weight when I remarried and had kids, and I've been clinging. It's like I've been clinging to that extra weight. And when I read that, I'm thinking, bingo, that's why, because I've got this deep seated fear of being hurt. And it's like, wow, I wonder how many people out there feel that way, you know, about they're clinging to that extra weight, or they're using it as a tool to identify with their problems. Like, well, I can't lose weight because I've got this, and this going on, but it's like a topic of conversation for them. I mean, am I on the right track? I mean, I'm sure you've dealt with that a lot more.
Yes, very much, very much. There is a very high correlation between, and again, I'm not saying it's a cause and effect, but there's a strong correlation between any kind of sexual abuse and eating disorders. And then this has been well researched. I wanted to add that I have a whole chapter in my book Starting Monday on managing intimacy, which deals a lot with what you're talking about. You know, we can manage intimacy by changing our weight, but it's not going to make us feel proud, and it's if we have to do it that way, it's probably only a pseudo intimacy that we're maintaining. That when we are in touch with our own feelings and act on them appropriately, that's when we can manage intimacy. With people getting too close or too far away, how they treat us, your feelings will, which you understand probably now, is your feelings will give you all you need to know about another person and your relationship. And but many women and men to an extent, I've treated some men who have used weight as a way to control intimacy. It simply doesn't work, and it leaves you very unhappy.
That was a powerful thing for me to read it, because it's like I've known it, you know, like perhaps unconsciously, but reading it in words, it's like, okay, that was a trigger for me, because it made so much sense. And you know, and I see that with my family, you know, my siblings, all of my sisters have had issues with weight, and not all of them have been, you know, sexually abused, but we grew up with abuse. So there's so much that went on, and it's not about blaming my parents. It's about how what do you do with it? How do we work with this, with the knowledge that we have, how to move forward? And I appreciate that you give those tips, a lot of those skills, you teach that in your book, and how to identify those things. One thing I really loved is your phrase on ditch the scale and stop focusing on weight, which is the end of a process, instead focus on eating, which is the beginning of it. You talk about follow the rules of appetite for hunger, food choice, enjoying eating, and stopping when full or satisfied. You know what I love about this? It's not micromanaging. I used to count all my calories. I'd drive myself bananas. I'm already managing my kid's diabetes, and I was starting to count all, and I was like, I was stressing out, and then I would binge. I'm like, forget this. I don't really care how many calories are in this. You know, I'm hungry. I want to eat. So it's this is all part of learning to live, you know, learning these skills and creating a balanced life, you know.
My first book, The Rules of Normal Eating, talks about appetite. You know, what is hunger? How do we know we're hungry? How hungry do we want to be to eat? Choosing satisfying foods. There's no good or bad foods. There's a nutritional continuum. So making choices of foods that you really want to eat, eating consciously, staying aware, without distractions, chewing, letting food sit on your tongue, and then stopping when you're full, which is quantity, or satisfied, which is quality. And those are really the basics not of healthy eating, because healthy eating has to do with the types of foods, but in terms of the process of eating according to appetite. And I encourage people to become normal eaters, and then when that has taken hold, which is, you know, maybe many months to a few years, it can take that long, then tweak the diet to become more healthy. And
that works.
That works. And then it sticks and it stays. And you've got both normal eating and healthy eating.
Right, and it's gradual. It's not this quick fix thing, because that is why you were saying that's why diets fail, because people want this quick fix. They want it now. They want to see results right away, and when they don't see results, they give up and they go right back to their unhealthy eating, and it's a vicious cycle. And go ahead.
It's also people who are prone to do that are prone to all or nothing thinking, teach people baby steps. I don't care what it looks like to you that someone is taking a giant leap. That just isn't how life works. It's all baby steps. And you have to cheerlead yourself the whole way. Keep your eye, on the prize and pay attention to how you feel. Don't compare eyes on your own plate. Don't compare yourself to other people. And these things really work, but as you say, they take more time. But you know, time goes by anyway, so what's the difference? The whole point
is true.
You get there. If you're going to walk across the room, the only way you're not going to get to the other side is if you stop walking. So it doesn't matter how many steps it takes to get there. What matters is that you keep walking till you get there.
Right, exactly. You know, I there's a quote that I saw somewhere out there. It was about, it was a photo of an overweight person that was like going around a track or going down a street, like he was running or jogging. And it was basically stating that he's doing far more than the person who's just sitting on the couch. And in other words, don't criticize him because maybe he's heavy. Maybe he's finally, you know, he's doing something, which is better than nothing. And it was, I can't even remember what the advertisement was for, what company it was for, but it was really about, it was an encouraging thing because it was about that. It was about the baby steps. And I think we need more of that. We need more of that encouragement. And it's also important to, you know, have friends or colleagues or people who are part of your cheering group, even if it's just one other person. It really does help to have that moral support besides just you, because sometimes if you feel like you want to fall off the wagon, as it were, you're having a bummed out day, just someone who might be able to listen to what's really going on. And then I think once you feel listened and validated, you make better choices. I mean, am I on the right track there?
Absolutely. And part of the problem comes from when you're children not having people do that. And then you start to rely on food because you feel, well, people aren't there for me. But the fact is you couldn't choose those people in childhood. You can choose to have supportive, caring people around you in adulthood, and that makes all the difference.
Absolutely. And, you know, you actually cover this in the book, and we won't have time to discuss it, but about the phrase that food is your friend, and it's like, nope. Really not. It is not the friend at all. It's just an object. It's a thing. And so it's I thought it was a really interesting perception on that, but our listeners are going to have to read the book to learn more about that. So again, thank you so much, Karen. I really, really enjoyed having you on my show. This was such an important topic. I thoroughly appreciate your work. I'm going to look into your other books, the one starting Monday, and your other work. And everyone, listen, you can visit her website at Karen R. .com.
It's Koenig.
K-A-R-E-N. I'm sorry, Koenig?
Yes.
Okay, so K-A-R-E-N, R as in Robert, K as in Kite, O-E-N-I-G.com. I have this link on my website here for projectempowerment.info on the show link. And Karen, there's one last question I ask my listener or my guest, and just answer whatever comes off the top of your head. What would you suggest to our listeners to empower their lives right now?
To be curious and compassionate to themselves.
I love it. I love it. So everyone, all healing and empowerment begins from within, and I'll need your help to do that. Please visit my link to projectempowerment.info and favorite the show, leave a message, or contact me direct at kathleen@millikan.com. I'd love to hear from you. Everyone, thank you again, and have the most amazing day. Bye-bye.